We'll move to the second case of the morning now, number 023441, Osler Institute Incorporated against Lois Ford. Mr. Whaley.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel? May it please the court, my name is Alan Whaley. I'm here on behalf of the appellant in this case, Osler Institute, Inc. Your Honors, the issue before the court this morning is the validity of the district court's order of August 19, 2002, which constituted a sua sponte order of summary judgment. Because that order was entered without adequate notice and without an opportunity for Osler to respond and present evidence, the order should be reversed and the cause remanded. The standard of review, as I'm sure the court is aware, is a review de novo. All facts and inferences should be weighed in favor of Osler Institute. If there is any genuine issue of material fact, the order should be reversed. The key issue here is the perhaps two-part issue of notice and opportunity to present evidence. In terms of the record before the court, there are two methods by which Osler Institute and the defendant in this case could have received adequate notice. One of those is the discussion at the pretrial conference of July 8, 2002. Another would be the court's actual written entry of the same date. And a possible third would be the actual content of the argument that was held, the hearing that was held on the trial brief issues that occurred on July 24. None of these passages or occurrences or events would put a reasonable attorney or party on notice that the district court was contemplating rulings that would dispose of the entire case before trial. As the first example, let's talk about the discussion at the July 8 pretrial conference. The district court judge noted that the trial briefs submitted by the parties, particularly the defendants, raised what he called substantial issues and he wanted to discuss them. Importantly, the defendants had not moved for summary judgment, but had simply raised issues in its trial brief. Even the defendant apparently anticipated that hearing evidence was going to be necessary, judging by the language that he used in his own trial brief. And the district court, as it could have, did not invite the defendant to move for summary judgment. Rather, the district court's language was much more to the effect that discussion and oral argument was needed to narrow the issues, clarify some that might be questions of law, which might be questions of fact, and to help frame the issues before trial. Osler's attorney had only just been handed the defendant's trial brief that morning. The court wanted to give Osler's trial counsel fair opportunity to review and respond to the arguments in that brief, so instead of commencing the trial on July 22nd, as was scheduled, it said, let's come back in 2 weeks and have an argument on these issues in the trial brief instead of starting trial that day.
Now, at that point, what do you think a reasonable attorney would have thought the judge was up to? I mean, you're going to come back in 2 weeks. What did you have to be prepared to do when you walked in that courtroom at the end of those 2 weeks?
I think a reasonable attorney would have thought that these issues needed to be discussed and narrowed. The judge specifically said in his discussion that there were issues that were fairly dispositive, I think was his phrase.
Didn't he say that he was going to rule in 2 weeks?
I think what his language was we have issues that are addressed here, some of which may be fairly dispositive.
And
we will have our hearing and our oral argument in 2 weeks, and then reset the trial or not, depending on what we decide. I think those were pretty close to the exact words.
That's not my recollection of what he said.
I'm sorry?
That's not my recollection of what the record shows he said.
Are you talking about the transcript now, Your Honor, of the July 8th?
I'm talking about what he said you were coming back for in 2 weeks, which I think was Judge Ripple's question, wasn't it, Judge Ripple?
No, what did you think was going to happen that day?
I think trial counsel reasonably believed that they were going to narrow issues. Among the issues that they were talking about narrowing were construing the liquidated damages clause.
Chief Hall, didn't the judge also make it pretty clear that whether he would have to set a new trial date or not was still up in the air? He might not have to set a trial date.
And that's an argument that the defendant makes in its brief before this court. I think a just as reasonable an interpretation of that language is, because you said we'll reset the trial or not, depending on what we decide, is that let's clarify these issues. He asked about settlement. It would be a reasonable attorney who would think, all right, if we narrow the issues, then maybe we all sit back and say, all right, do we want to have a trial in another month? Or are the issues now sufficiently narrow that we're going to take another shot at settling? I think that would have been an equally reasonable interpretation. I think the jurisprudence of this court shows that if you're going to enter sua sponte summary judgment, you have to be pretty clear and unequivocal about your intent. The kinds of cases that this court has rendered on this subject show that even notice that is more clear and more specific than Osler Institute got was considered inadequate.
I want to get back to Judge Ripple's question, which
sure.
I think is the heart of this case. The perplexing thing here is why the defense did not move for summary judgment. But they didn't. And now the trial judge looks at these briefs and says, I don't know if a trial is going to be... I think this is what he's saying to himself. I'm looking at this. I don't know if a trial is going to be necessary here. So he conducts this proceeding, and Judge Ripple asks you what a reasonable lawyer is going to think here, and I would suspect that reasonable lawyer is going to say, my case might be in trouble here. If you say narrowing the issue, I think fair interpretation of that is that you better come in with something to defend your position and your entitlement to proceeding to trial here.
Well, Your Honor, I think that a reasonable attorney might consider that the judge was skeptical of the defamation count. The words that I think he used there were fairly dispositive on defamation. But I don't think he used language anywhere near that clear on any of the other things. And I think it would be reasonable for a trial counsel to have thought that we may be narrowing these issues, and I think the discussion on July 24 clearly bears this out. They're talking about what is your evidence going to be, what's your position on this issue, so that we can clarify things and the judge will have a better idea of what he thinks is frameable as a question of law, which he'll take, or things which have questions of fact in them. And more to the point, Your Honor, at the July 24 hearing itself, not only was the discussion along these lines, what do you anticipate the evidence is going to be, but no evidence was offered, no evidence was admitted, there were no depositions filed, the parties were represented not only by counsel but were there personally, the judge asked clarification questions on occasion of the parties, but no one was sworn, no one was put on the stand. Even the defendant's lawyer commented at one point during the July 24 hearing about what evidence he intended to present. I venture to say that even the defense lawyer was as surprised as Osler was when they got the order, which was at least entitled an order on motions in limine and motions for sanctions, and realized that the whole case was gone.
But I don't want to jump in on all your time here, but the notice thing is,
I think
it's a weak argument for you. So why don't you talk about the merits of why you were entitled to go to trial?
Well, I think to go to the merits, even in the partial and summary kind of discussion that the judge had with the lawyers about what they thought the evidence was going to be, I think that indicates that there were multiple questions of fact about the salient issues that were going to be tried. Mr. Trueblood, trial counsel, did point out several times that there were differences of opinion, not only about facts, but about legal theories and legal arguments. And examples of these are the extent and nature of Lois Ford's knowledge of confidential and proprietary information, whether she actually started working with the competitor before the ostensible end of her employment. That was alluded to by Mr. Trueblood, trial counsel. In addition to that, there are several specific examples of things that would constitute a protectable interest under this confidential information, proprietary information issue that were alluded to, but which Osler did not have an opportunity to present evidence on. Many of those examples were at least referred to by Mr. Trueblood, but a complete opportunity wasn't given to address them. And examples include her knowledge, because of her extensive experience, especially with the psychiatric seminar faculty, of which faculty got the best evaluations, and therefore which would be more successful in future seminars. Her relationship with this faculty, which in fact got so close to some of the psychiatric seminar faculty, and she asked them to participate so often, that this core group eventually decided that it did not need to coordinate its efforts to Osler, but could break out on its own and present its own seminars. Mrs. Ford also knew, because of her employment relationship and because of her status as a de facto board member and an insider with the corporation, that it was one of Osler Institute's practices and business strategies not to use the same people for the same seminars over and over for several reasons. One, the kind of establishing a core group that would gain its own ideas about presenting its own seminars independently. More to the point, it was very much in Osler Institute's interest to try to spread out the faculty from various parts of the country and various teaching centers, because if the faculty are involved with Osler Institute seminars, they're going to let their residents back at medical schools know about the seminar coming up. So having a widely dispersed faculty that includes lots of different people at different times from different locations was an important marketing and business strategy for Osler, of which Lois Ford was aware. But instead of diversifying the psychiatric seminar faculty, she did the opposite. Her selections from the list concentrated the faculty in this core group that eventually became a competitor. Those are specific examples of the kinds of things that she knew and was taught because of her experience as an insider in presenting, especially the psychiatric seminars. One additional example of that, which is key and wouldn't necessarily be apparent on its face unless it were explained, and the jury would need to hear this too, is as a key part of a seminar for psychiatric residents studying for the psych boards. They have, as a great part of the time spent in the seminar, mock oral exams where interviews are conducted of actual psychiatric patients, and then the board candidate is asked to present the case, answer questions about the patient, and make diagnosis and treatment recommendations. To prepare these psych residents for the exam that was going to have that done, the seminar did the same thing. And knowing how and being able to make connections in the various communities where the seminar was presented to get psychiatric patients to come and participate was a very key skill for this particular seminar. It wasn't easy to do, and Lois Ford didn't know how to do it until she was taught how to do it. So those are examples that go to the issue of, did Lois Ford have confidential and proprietary information and unique knowledge that made her very able and maybe even prone to go off and try to use that knowledge herself? Other examples on the breach of fiduciary duty and the de facto director issue include these. The court, in the first place, did not apply the correct standard, which is whether Lois Ford acted as a de facto director. And we would say an added element of that would be, was she treated as a de facto director? Even with the partial summary of evidence that was permitted to be shown at this hearing and oral argument that the district court conducted, it was clear that she was acting in many ways for a time as a director, even though she had not been officially elected. Examples include, she attended some meetings and was paid for those meetings. She took minutes and she signed them as a secretary designate. She was also privy to much confidential discussion, some of which I just alluded to. Other examples would include being privy to confidential discussions about other employees, how their performance was going, and what their compensation was. Those are all indicia of being entrusted with the responsibilities of an actual board member, even if the election had not been officially confirmed as yet. So the acting as a director standard was clearly in play. There was clearly factual evidence that Oster wanted to be able to present for it, but was not given the opportunity. A final issue substantively, on which there are multiple questions of fact, is the interference with business relationships standard. First, the district court erred when it applied a standard requiring that an illegal act also be a part of the elements of the claim. This was debated quite a bit in the briefs, but briefly, there's a split in the Indiana Court of Appeals on the issue. The Bradley case says it's not required. The Levy case says it is, so there's the conflict. There's a Supreme Court case that cites the Levy decision in a footnote, recites all the elements except illegality. And contrary to the defendant's position, that's much more consistent with the illegal act requirement not being a part of that cause of action. So in terms of a substantive legal issue, we have two times where the district court applied an incorrect legal standard in addition to depriving Oster of an opportunity to present the facts. I see my time has almost expired, and that's a natural stopping place for me. I've reserved a few minutes for rebuttal, so I'll conclude.
Mr. Whaley, I noticed that you did not file a disclosure statement in this case until April 3rd. Did you just enter the case?
I just did, but I think we actually filed it. I'm not sure of the date. I actually had a phone exchange of phone messages with the court's office because they didn't get it at first. We filed it when we filed our card informing the court that I would be participating in oral argument.
I see. The panel has not yet received that disclosure statement, so I will ask the clerk to make sure that the disclosure statement of Mr. Whaley is distributed to the panel immediately.
I believe I have a copy with me.
Well, so if you would discuss that with the people in the clerk's office before leaving, we would appreciate
sure, Will, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll hear now from Mr. Modessa.
Your Honors, my name is Raymond Modessa, counsel. I represent Lois Ford, who was the defendant in the trial court and appellee herein. This court has the duty at this time to decide actually three issues. Is there anything in the record to sustain Judge McKinney's findings and dismissal of counts 2, count 3, and count 4? There are three actual separate areas. I'd like to take them in reverse, if I may, because I think it makes more sense based upon the status of the record. Count 4 is a count for interference with business relationships. Throughout the briefing of this case, counsel for the appellant, plaintiff underneath, has consistently misconstrued Indiana law and the theory of plaintiff's own case. The allegations in the complaint and in the contentions maintain and allege that Lois Ford interfered with Oster's relationship with these doctors over here. It's undisputed in this case, those doctors were never under any, quote, contract. Therefore, there could not, under Indiana law, be an action for interference with contractual relations. That was the standard in Bradley versus Hall. That was the standard in the Bochnowski case. Not the tort of interference with business relationships. In the Levy case, Mrs. Levy was a teacher. She sued on two theories: tort of business interference and tort of contractual interference. The lower court granted summary judgment on both theories based upon the absence of the illegality element.
Let me ask you before you get too involved in this. One of the issues here is whether there was sufficient notice given that the court was considering summary judgment and stopping this case in its tracks. Why didn't you move for summary judgment?
My reasons are simply that part of it was economic, part of it was the timing of the numerous mediations and settlement discussions that were held, and what various parties thought had transpired at those particular sessions with Magistrate Hussman.
I don't understand economic, because usually it's economically wise to get out of the case on summary judgment rather than going to a trial, and it looks like you were ready to go to trial here at all times.
In this case, Your Honor, we felt it was cheaper, frankly, to proceed to trial.
Yeah, I understand our cases like that.
And that was, with my client, that was the economics of the best decision.
Okay.
If I might again go back to count four on the interference issue, the appellate court in Levy set aside the summary judgment that was based upon the tort of interference with contractual relations because, they said, you don't need the element of illegality. But the Court of Appeals sustained the action of interference with business relations because they held that tort did require illegality, and it cited restatement, which essentially was talking about you need a higher standard, more proof to make out the tort of interference with business relationship because it doesn't require a contract. That's a question of law. This court should not upset count four under any circumstance. There is nothing the plaintiff can do to present any further evidence. It's undisputed on this issue. The law of the state of Indiana is undisputed on that issue. Let me now go to count three. Count three was a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. This court can find in this record ample reasons to sustain this conclusion of Judge McKinney. First, the complaint itself says the plaintiff was, quote, a member of the board of directors. The contentions filed under Rule 16 don't even say that. The only reference to the board of directors in the plaintiff's contentions is that she failed to resign from as a member of the board of directors. There is no qualification of the nature of the director, such as de facto or de jure. It just says a director. Based upon that, we filed a request for admissions. And it says, admit, that Lois Ford was never a director of the Osler Institute, Inc. You'll note in Judge McKinney's opinion of the repeated and repeated violations of court rules by Osler in this case, including the failure to make requests for admission responses within the time permitted under the rules. Accordingly, it was deemed under Rule 37 to have been admitted. Once you have a deeming rule that says this is admitted for all purpose of this case, you don't need to go any further. She was not a director. It's really that simple. But in addition to that, we had the minutes which set up that she was not a director. Under any of the cases, the McGirt case, the Banker Trust case, you cannot be a de facto director unless you assume the position under color of right or title. Assumption requires consent to be so. The minutes attached to the record, stipulated exhibits are evidence, undisputably says she's not a director. She didn't consent and was not going to consent unless there was an audit and there was D&O coverage provided to a director. End of story. There is nothing else that needs to be done. No evidence can controvert a deemed request to admit. That's just not possible. So now you take care of count two and count three. Now we go to, count three and count four. Now we go to count two. This is the basic count on contract. Did she violate the contract? And was the court appropriate in doing what it did relative to the contract? Notice issues first. How could any lawyer, and I understand counsel for the appellant here today was not at these hearings. Neither was the counsel who wrote the brief. Your Honors, there is no way one could have attended the July 8th hearing and not understood what Judge McKinney was going to do. In my response brief, I recite for two pages all of the questions of law that really were up to the court. At one point during the hearing on the 8th, Judge McKinney asked Mr. Trueblood when it was he should decide these issues. Mr. Trueblood says, anytime you want. He didn't say, don't do it until I have given more evidence. Anytime you want. He also noted to Mr. Trueblood, there are serious matters about the validity of the employment contract signed by Ms. Ford. That was the issue, one of the issues, and also issues of interference with contractual relationships. These are the issues he wanted to discuss on the 22nd. Keep in mind, when we had this argument on the 22nd, that was one day following when the trial was supposed to begin. After 2 years, parties are presumed to be ready. The court invited, at that hearing, a recitation of facts, just like it had a recitation of facts at the July 8th hearing. Goes on to pages. What knowledge did she gain from Osler that she took to the other institute that causes you your trouble? Response, the nuts and bolts of putting on a medical seminar. Judge McKinney, under Indiana law, is the finder of the fact and the determiner of a question of law as to whether a covenant is reasonable. He determined, as under Indiana law, that these covenants were not reasonable, that there were no facts presented by assertion that could possibly convert Ms. Ford into some sort of an employee who was cloaked with special powers or was cloaked with special confidential responsibilities. She was, in short, an administrative personnel.
She had some confidential information, didn't she?
No, Your Honor, she didn't.
How about the evaluations of the various speakers?
Those are the evaluations of the people who left. She had that information. That is not confidential, however.
Well, why not? I mean, if you know that, you know what combination of speakers is going to put on a good program for a group of doctors who want to get through the psychiatric boards.
There is no evidence that let's assume she had that information. Now there must be evidence that she disseminated that information
or used it.
Okay. There is no such evidence that she used it. The persons who created this competing entity left Osler. They were never under a contract, and it was they who contacted Lois Ford, not the reverse.
Who selected the speakers for the new competitors program?
The speakers were the same five people. They didn't have speakers. I mean, they didn't go get other speakers.
Yeah, I understand, but who is it who contacted them and who selected those speakers for the program? Somebody had to make the decision that those were the physicians who were going to instruct the student physicians at the competitor's seminar. Who made that decision?
You mean at the Otho seminar?
No, at the competitor's seminar.
The competitor seminar speakers were the owners. They didn't do what Osler did. They were the owners and the speakers. They didn't go get outside speakers. Therefore, any of that information obviously was not used.
Would you have a different case if Ms. Ford had put this new group together as opposed to the group forming itself and then going to Ms. Ford and asking her to join?
It depends on the element of time. It depends on the accounts you're referring to. If you're talking about the non-compete count, the answer would still be no. She still has to have information that is a protectable interest. You can go on the website, Your Honor, and get the names of all these people at any given time. I mean, this is not secret information.
Does the record indicate whether in it was contemplated that in future programs she would be the person selecting speakers?
For which entity?
For the competitive entity, the competitor entity.
There were no other speakers. Only the owners.
I understand. For the program that was put on, only one.
All programs.
What was her job? Did her job include? Was that a fixed situation, or did indeed that entity keep open the possibility of using other speakers?
No, it was fixed. Oh, green, orange. Okay. With regard to the elements of whether this court can in fact uphold the position of Judge McKinney, I'd just simply like to state a few principles. One is, this court has held on numerous occasions that it should affirm the lower trial court on any basis found in the record. This court has also upheld sui sponte dismissals of complaints, such as in Vaughn versus in the Vaughn case, if the outcome is clear. And the record in this case is that the outcome is clear. Mrs. Ford was not in a position that the plaintiff would like her to be. And I see my red light went off, so I better sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Modesto. Sir, your time has expired, but I will give you 30 seconds if you have something particular you need. You did, sir, yes.
Judge Evans alluded to the notice issue, and I'd like to call the court's attention in particular to several cases where judges on this panel found that more notice was still not enough. The Simpson case cited in our brief, where there were actually some letters submitted by both sides pursuant to a discussion, that was found to be not enough notice, probably more notice than trial counsel here had. The Avilas case, which I think Judge Ripple participated in, the defendant actually moved for summary judgment.
We have opinions for the court. They're not our individual opinions.
I'm sorry?
They're not our individual opinions when we write an opinion.
I understand, Your Honor.
For the court.
But that's
speak
a,
for the court.
That's a good example of someone who got some notice because a motion was actually filed, but a particular issue wasn't raised until the reply brief, and the court concluded that that was not adequate notice. Maybe one more point, that is, in terms of evidence that Lois Ford turned the relationship to her advantage and against her employer's advantage, that also could have been presented regarding things that she was doing contrary to Oster's specific preferences while the employment relationship existed. What I'm alluding to is the relationship that she was constantly building with the group that became the competitors.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank both counsel today for their presentations and help in the case is taken under advisement.